This is North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Phoebe Judge. A few years ago, the writer Philip Gerard decided to take a journey down one of his favorite rivers, the Cape Fear. He would travel the whole thing, starting at the base of the Deep and Haw Rivers and ending up at Baldhead Island, in a canoe. And he documents that journey in his book, Down the Wild Cape Fear. He joined me in the studio to talk about the experience, and before we began, I asked him to read a passage.
I have lived beside the Cape Fear River for more than 20 years. I've run its length, 200-odd miles of foaming rapids, placid eddies, tan and dark water hiding snakes and snapping turtles, in canoes, kayak, sailboat, runabout, fishing boat, and ship. And I've run parts of it many times. I've long wanted to write about this river, to which I felt such a visceral connection. And the best way to do that was to go back on it again, starting where the river is born and riding it to the sea.
There are something like 17 major rivers in North Carolina. Where does the Cape Fear River rank in terms of stature and grandiosity and all of those other things, in your opinion?
I would put it number one. It is, for example, the only one that runs directly into the sea. It's one of only four contained within the boundaries of the state. I think of it as one of the great American rivers in that, like the Hudson River in New York, for example, it plays such a huge role in the early settlement, in the Revolution, in the Civil War, all kind of the major historical punctuation points of our history. It's right there.
So it's about 200 miles, and we're talking, and it really does kind of run through the heart of the state. Where does it begin, and where does it end?
Sure. Well, it really does run right through the heart of North Carolina, and 26 of the 100 counties are touched by the Cape Fear Basin. 15% of the land area of North Carolina, something like 10 million people live within the boundary of it. It starts where the Deep and the Haw Rivers come together, just above Buckhorn Dam. And then about 200 miles later, it comes out at Baldhead Island, just off Southport. And you can follow the fairway out to the sea buoy, and now you're in the Atlantic Ocean. And one of the fascinating things about the trip was going from a very narrow, fast-moving, whitewater, cold river that rushes along with incredible excitement out to this gigantic, broad estuary where container ships are standing out to sea and tugboats and pilot boats are plying around. And you see just the massive power where the river finally ends.
It's almost like the Mississippi, where it starts with this little trickle up at the boundary waters, and then before you know it, you're coming out in New Orleans, and the whole world looks different.
Right, and one of the things that this taught me was that any river really begins with every bit of runoff, every ditch, every drainage ditch in a farmer's field or culvert along a highway, every little tiny creek that is dry until it rains and suddenly becomes a little freshet. All of those things, there are literally thousands of miles of those tributaries that come into the upper basin of the Cape Fear, so that you can have a rainstorm, a rain event, and all of a sudden the water level rises dramatically. It's still a wild river.
And as you say, there are thousands of these tributaries which are flowing into the Cape Fear. Tributaries, will say, there can be tiny little streams or something much more substantial. What type of environmental impacts is the Cape Fear River up against? I would imagine just from a lot of different sources of water coming into this river.
It comes off of driveways, but you wash your car, and the next thing you know, whatever chemicals you put in, you know, whatever wax or whatever you use is now down in the storm drain. That goes into the creek, that goes down into the tributary. If you're a farmer and you're a concentrated chicken farmer, say, and you've got thousands of chickens in a house and you've got mounds of chicken waste piled outside, which you're allowed to do under North Carolina, lack of regulation, all of a sudden that turns soupy and liquid, and that's in a drainage ditch, and it runs along the field and finally into the branch and finally into the creek and finally into the river, containing, among other things, massive levels of arsenic, the hog waste that is slathered onto fields by the ton. So it has a huge impact on the river, and it's why things like buffer zones, having even a few feet of vegetation between a raw field that's been plowed and the river, matters, because that keeps silt from getting into the river. It keeps some of the other things that ordinarily would come into the river that are now being soaked up by the vegetation, why the wetlands are so important down in Brunswick County. So yeah, it has huge implications, and I think when you begin to think of the river basin as an entire united dynamic entity, it makes more sense to pay attention to what you're doing in your own property.
In your journey down the Cape Fear River, you mention lots of times where you are in a wild, rushing river in the middle of forest and woods and without anybody around. But this river goes through some very populated areas of the state. How is sprawl kind of coming down on the river? Are you on the river at times and looking up and there are people and parking lots and cars?
Well, the really cool thing about the Cape Fear River is there's two things that are contradictory. One is it's been engineered from start to finish. That is, from the sea buoy at Bald Head Island all the way up to Jordan Lake Dam, there have been dams, locks, navigation facilities, dredging, all kind of things, and yet the river stubbornly remains wild. And one of the reasons is that so much of it, especially on the western bank, is what we would call wetland. They used to call it swamp, that you can't get to the river very easily from a lot of places, and therefore that's protected the river. So when the river overflows, it simply flows deep and wide and gets out into the hinterlands. And it's really amazing. You can go past Fayetteville, and except for, I think, three bridges or so, you can never know you're in a major metropolitan area. You'd only know about the Army base because you'll hear the live firing if you hear it, as we did when we went by. If you go past Lillington or Elizabethtown, you know, slightly smaller cities on the river, you could pass them by and hardly know they're there, and you could be in those towns and never know the river is there. For a long time, people looked at the river as a threat and stayed away from it. And in a way, that's protected it. But in another way, I think a lot of those towns have turned their back on what is their best, not just maybe picturesque asset, but economic asset. People love to look at water. Restaurants love to be on the water. You know, David Everett's got that great barbecue place in Lillington, and you go there and you got a front row seat to a beautiful river, and it's different every day, it's different every season. And I think that's the exciting thing about the Cape Fear. It really can be wild and feel like you're in the 17th century when you're floating along among the, you know, the great bowers of poison ivy in the spring, and the songbirds are fluttering and the ospreys are going by, and, you know, it's almost outrageous.
You keep talking about this river as wild, and you went down it in a canoe. What type of dangers, physical dangers, did you encounter on this river, which was rushing at some point?
The Cape Fear River is different depending on how much water is in it, which depends on both rainfall and what's happening at Jordan Lake Dam. So on any given set of rapids, and there are many more very kind of sporty rapids on the Cape Fear than you might imagine if you've only seen the lower reaches of the Cape Fear, on any given day it could be different. And so even an experienced paddler will have to choose a different route through a rapid. So on our very first rapids coming in at Buckhorn Dam, my paddling partner David and I took the right-hand chute, which was, in retrospect, a mistake. It turned out to be the leftover man-made chute from an old navigation lock or something. And boy, was that sporty. We went flying down there, and we were like, well, this is neat, you know. And then kind of felt a little bit maybe arrogant, confident, because we'd gone through there maybe half a mile and gotten our first splashes of white water in the face and didn't overturn. But of course, very quickly, we learned that it was possible to go down the river upside down and backward as well.
And the fear here is that this is a river that in some parts is shallow and some parts is deep. So you have rocks and you have tree limbs, and it's running fast. And so if your foot gets caught or something.
Yeah, the great dangers are you hit a rock and you kind of broach to and the whole thing turns over and you're pinned or something, or you hit a strainer, which is one of those tree limbs that's down in the water. And there are many of them, especially after the various hurricanes that have come up the river. And your boat can go up against them, but you can't actually go through them. And so you either have to go under them or climb up on top of them. But if you get pinned, you're in trouble. So the rocks, the problem with that is if you're out of your boat, you get knocked out of your boat somehow. You've got to keep your legs up in the air. If your leg gets caught under a submerged rock, then you will be facing downstream and not able to get out of the rock, and the water will drown you.
What's your favorite part of all of the 200 miles that you went down? What's your favorite?
Well, there are so many, but one of them would be Lanier Falls, where we stopped and spent a good hour and a half just running the chute over and over again. I got out, and we ran it both in canoes, and then we got out and just sort of ran it with our life jackets on and, you know, slid around on the rocks. And it was a great sunny day. It was spring. There was a big pool there next to the rushing water where we could kind of bathe and just play. And it was like being 10 years old again. It reminded me of going down to the what we called the creek when I was a kid, and just on a hot day, peeling off your shirt and diving in and playing around the swimming hole.
Philip Gerard is a professor at UNC Wilmington and the author of Down the Wild Cape Fear, a river journey through the heart of North Carolina. You can find out more information about his book on our website, wunc.org. I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.